Welcome to the Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening this week. Napoleon Bonaparte Broward may be best remembered as the Florida governor who began draining the Everglades. He was governor more than a century ago, and his policy was to empty what he called the pestilence-ridden swamp and make an empire of the Everglades. Today, that includes Broward County. And while governor, he also wanted Congress to buy land to create a separate territory for blacks. This was almost 50 years after the end of the Civil War. Broward's segregationist views have led the county named after him to remove his statue from the county courthouse. This is where we begin the Florida Roundup here today. Susan from Davie wrote us saying that she's lived in Broward for 30 years, saying, "I'm not shocked by the latest information about Napoleon Bonaparte Broward. We could say he was a man of his time, but that doesn't mean we have to honor him today." Willie in Oakland Park wrote us that you can't completely ignore or rewrite history. We still have a county named after him. I think the statue should stay. Ed P. in Lauderhill wrote, "If we are going to ignore the contributions of everyone who had beliefs that were commonly held in their era but are now unacceptable, we have a monumental task ahead." He concluded his comments to us saying, "Political correctness is a road to the ridiculous." This is where we begin on the Roundup with Mayor Barbara Sharif, Mayor of Broward County. Welcome back to the Florida Roundup and WLRN, Mayor.
Thank you for having me.
Has the statue been removed yet from the courthouse?
No, it hasn't been removed yet. That's going to be happening over the next couple of weeks.
Where will it go when it's taken down?
So back where it was, you know, the history of this is that this is a statue that was given to us by a gentleman named Skip Wellner. In 1982, it was donated to the county commission. In 1983, it was accepted by the county commission and placed into storage where it stayed for 10 years. So in 1993, somebody plopped it in the courthouse. Well, that wasn't done under the direction of the commission, and it's artwork. It's something that we have art pieces that we move all the time to different places, depending on what people's preference is. And so this is not something that we commissioned or paid for or requested to be there. So the decision to move it, it's not just about, I think that when people talk about rewriting history, I think that's a kind of an inappropriate way to look at it. Mm-hmm. You know, if that was a statue of Hitler standing in the middle of our courthouse, what people of Jewish faith wanted there. And so this is how offensive it is. And this is a statue of a man who believed in segregation and could have possibly been a real racist. Mm-hmm. And people are looking at it like that. And so what's the downfall of moving it to a place like a museum? And so that's pretty much where it's going to go. We're going to try to put it in a museum.
You're going to try to put it in a museum, in a county museum?
Well, I'm not sure. Okay. That's where we have to talk with staff some more and figure out where the most appropriate place would be.
So initially, this statue is destined back into storage where it was for 10 years before it came out in 1993. But you do think that it could come back into public view at some time in the future. I want to ask you about that, but back to the decision to remove the statue. Was this your sole decision as mayor?
No, actually, it's not. Okay. When the staff and the administrator have received complaints from the T.J. Redick Bar Association, followed by some supportive, statements from some of the more key players at the courthouse, such as Michael Satz, Howard Finkelstein, and Judge Tudor.
Mm-hmm. Prominent folks in the legal community in Broward County. Yeah.
Right. So these are people that use the courthouse on a regular basis. This is their arena. This is where they go to work every day.
And were these new complaints? In other words, have these complaints been on the books or building since 1993? Or because a researcher recently kind of rediscovered some of these segregationist writings that the governor made, Governor Broward, we're talking about, made back in 1905, 06, 07, that have recently become kind of public again. Did that reignite something, or frankly, was it new complaints because of these writings coming to light lately?
That's exactly right. They were new complaints because of the writings that had come to light.
And so back to the decision that was made. You saw some of these complaints coming in. You mentioned that it wasn't a county commission decision in 1993 to put the statue of Governor Broward in the courthouse, and it's not a county commission decision to take it down. So at whom's feet does that decision lie?
That's at the county administrator and the assistant county administrator who's over the courthouse. And I support that decision. And I have let that be known. I'm not sure. I don't talk to my other colleagues about things like this because, you know, we have the Sunshine Law. So if we were going to talk about something like this, we would talk about it from the dais.
Yeah,
but
you do it in a meeting. Sure. Certainly. Right.
So I've expressed myself.
This was
them.
An administrative decision, one that you as mayor, Mayor Barbara Sharif of Broward County, support. We got a couple of other comments from listeners. Chris C. from Hollywood wrote us, "If we don't remember the past, we are doomed to repeat it. Removing such items are not teachable moments. While we should never condone or honor racism in any form, it cannot erase it from our history." Audrey from Dade County saying, "Absolutely nothing in Dade or Broward should be named after any people who have hurt the African-American population." Mayor Sharif, you know all of this is happening, of course, in the broader national context, this discussion and debate that many communities are having over statues. Hollywood is having this over street names that were named after Confederate generals and Civil War military folks that fought on the side of the South. How should these memorials be viewed today?
So like I said before, it's our history of racism and segregation and abuse of the African-American and Black community is one that's painful. It is a truth that is always there. It is something that we are going to live with forever. But at the same time, it is not necessary to have a daily reminder of it every time you walk into a public courthouse. And as I stated before, if this was something offensive to some of the people who have experienced some other atrocities in history, such as the Holocaust and others, they would want not to have this statue reminding them every single day when they go to work of that past. And while moving it is not erasing history, we're just putting it in the appropriate place, which I believe is a museum.
Mayor Barbara Sharif with us, Mayor of Broward County. Thanks for your time today on the Florida Roundup. Nice to hear from you again.
Thank you for having me.
Mayor Sharif joining us on the Roundup via Skype. Still to come on this pledge edition, will plastic foam coffee cups and food containers be banned from the beach in Hollywood? That's next as the Florida Roundup continues. Welcome back to the Florida Roundup here on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson, a special pledge edition today. Thanks for listening. Miami Beach, Deerfield Beach, now maybe Hollywood Beach. Hollywood commissioners are expected to vote soon on a proposal that would ban plastic foam containers from public spaces. It could become the latest city to ban this plastic foam, at least partially. State law prevents cities from outright bans. Mayor Josh Levy is the mayor of Hollywood and joins us on the telephone. Mayor Levy, welcome to the Florida Roundup on WLRN. Thanks for your time today.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Susanna Bryan is a reporter for the South Florida Sun Sentinel. She joins us via Skype. Susanna, welcome to the Florida Roundup. Thanks for your time.
Thanks for having me.
Mayor Levy, let's begin here. Describe this proposed ban. What do you folks want to do?
So look, certainly all of us in South Florida, I think, seeing the success in other cities, but more so because of the spirit that's been forwarded increasingly so by our environmentally conscious residents, certainly want to see the reduction of litter, harmful litter, specifically in the areas by our coastal waterways, our beach and the intracoastal, knowing how much of an issue this is for wildlife and the environment. These polystyrene and foam-based containers, coolers, and all don't biodegrade. They just stay on the ground. A lot of animals mistake them for food, and so we want to be better environmental stewards. So we're looking for ways to limit this.
Mayor Levy, how big of a problem is it up and down the shores and the waterways of Hollywood?
Well, look, probably similar to other cities in the coastal areas of South Florida. Certainly, it is a problem when you participate in beach cleanup sweeps on a volunteer basis. For example, on the beach, you certainly find polystyrene and styrofoam materials that are just there. So when you're cleaning up the beach as a volunteer, you see that it's there and you know that it's not going away unless a human picks it up.
Yeah.
Because it's not going to biodegrade.
Susanna Bryan with the Sun Sentinel, does this proposal have support on the commission?
Yes and no. They supported it in September, but some of the commissioners are concerned about enforcement. and whether the police, the park rangers would have the staff time to go out and you know, check everybody to see if they're walking around with polystyrene containers. So there was a decision at the October 4th meeting to delay the vote until November so they can work that out.
So, Mr. Mayor, what about the enforcement idea? This the proposal, I think, as written originally came with, a $500 fine and even the potential of jail time? Is that right?
So that's what we wanted to clean up and think through before we enacted the ordinance. The catch-all for a violation of any ordinance of the city is a catch-all penalty of up to $500 or 60 days in jail, depending, of course, on the gravity of what we're speaking with. Mm-hmm. We didn't want that catch-all to even be something related to this environmental effort. So we wanted to, and we began discussion in October about what the more appropriate enforcement impact would be on this. Look, nobody wants to give anybody any tickets or any monetary, and certainly not any jail time, of course, for what we hope would be a voluntary spirit of wanting to share in the protection of our beaches and not littering the city. So I think what we'll look to do is, of course, I don't expect personally the police or park rangers to really invest a lot of time into writing people tickets for polystyrene possession. But what I do want to see is a big educational effort that will compel the beachfront businesses to voluntarily choose to, and a little bit of carrot and stick, but more carrot to compel them and inspire them to be ocean-friendly restaurants. Yeah. The Surf Rider Foundation has a program to certify businesses on a voluntary basis. I think we'll get a lot more through education and voluntary compliance than we will using tickets and penalties.
Susanna, what the mayor is talking about there is the source of some of these plastic foam containers. What can you tell us about where these containers are coming from? Are they, polystyrene coolers that people are bringing from their own trunks to the beach, or are they coming from neighborhood restaurants?
I think the answer is both of those. I talked to several restaurant owners to see how they felt about this, and some of them were happy to learn that they wouldn't be fined, but when they learned that their customers could be fined as soon as they walked out of the restaurant onto a public sidewalk, they didn't like that, and they told me that they would, if the ban goes through, they would probably switch to the biodegradable takeout containers. A couple told me that if they have to do that, it's going to cost them more, and they'll probably end up passing that cost along to their customers.
The mayor talks about kind of a carrot to try to get the restaurants to move away from using these foam containers, and education as well. Is there a component of that of the proposal, Susanna, that supports that kind of messaging?
I think that the mayor might be the best one to answer that.
How about it? I'm sure you know the enforcement and the description and the definitions are all in the whereases are all there, but is there a component of pushing education?
There will be certainly. What I wanted to do was get something on the books that we could enforce and just have as a municipality, and then bring that new ordinance together with a big education effort to gather all the beachfront restaurants, for example, at the Beach Community Center, at our Garfield Street Garage, and really show them examples of commercially available, biodegradable takeout containers that they can easily procure through, you know, one of the local restaurant vendor supply houses. And really, again, increase the awareness and get them to voluntarily want to partake in this. I have to imagine that, you know, those restaurant owners who are on the beach love the natural quality of the beach and would be happy to participate in this effort.
Talking to Hollywood Mayor Josh Levy and Susanna Bryan, reporter for the Sun Sentinel, about a proposed ban of plastic foam containers in public spaces in Hollywood. Mayor Levy, to some degree, your hand is forced here by the state legislature here in Florida. In other words, you're not able to pass an ordinance in the city of Hollywood that would go after restaurants as private companies and private property and require them to not use plastic foam containers. Instead, what you have to do is go after whether or not these containers show up on public property. Is that correct?
Right, that is correct. We are preempted as a city from regulating businesses in this regard. So, but what the legislature did do, they at least let us, if we chose to, is ban the use of it, like you said, on private property, public property. And that's where we're also having the discussion is, you know, should this apply citywide? How can we, you know, be reasonable about this too? Right. If someone picks up a plastic container at a restaurant and walks on the sidewalk, you know, we don't want to also make people feel like we're overreaching. So we're going to have to find the right balance here. But in Hollywood's case, we had an ordinance in the 80s, I think, that was enacted that, you know, reflected this spirit, was a polystyrene ban for all properties east of the Intracoastal Waterway and on the Barrier Island. Trouble is, when that ordinance was drafted, the city commission at that time had put in some components that said that the ordinance would not be effective until the FDA or the Florida Department of Environmental Protection had certified that there were polystyrene alternatives out there that could be used to keep for food takeout, for example.
Right, there were food safety insurance.
I spoke with the city attorney. We all tried to reach out. We did reach out to the FDA and the Florida Department of Environmental Protection, asking them if they enacted or took actions that would satisfy those triggers in the ordinance that we have from the 80s, so that we could use that ordinance and not be subject to the later in time preemption by the state. And unfortunately for us, so far, we don't have yet any proof, and read directly from FDA and EPA, that they found those alternatives.
Yeah.
And so we still have trouble with trying to enforce our old ordinance, which is what a lot of residents would love to see, and myself included.
Susanna, let me ask you the limitations of this proposal. The mayor talks about it, you know, focused on the beach and some of these waterways. What are some of the limitations that you've been able to identify, or that restaurateurs and others that you've spoken to have looked at?
Well, I did talk to Bob Farrow, who owns Nick's over on the beach, mm-hmm. and about the ordinance that was passed 26 years ago. He mentioned that. He remembers that. He said he had to use paper straws that were individually wrapped. He said they were outrageously priced. He said, we did it for a year and no one ever said anything. He said they did send code officers from the city to check to make sure that he was not using plastic straws. And then they never came back. So that speaks to lack of enforcement,
right,
which goes back to what the commissioners were already concerned about. I was trying to find out from the restaurant owners what the difference in price was. And all they would say was, it's so much cheaper to use the polystyrene, which is probably why they're still doing it.
Yeah. Mayor Levy, what about the limitations here? If passed as proposed, would this exclusively deal with these plastic foam containers on the beach in kind of East Hollywood, or is this citywide?
So the spirit, like you said, was really driven out of those concerns for, you know, the waterways and the areas of the city that are close to the waterways. But the ordinance, though, that we considered in October, unless it's changed so far, has a general, you know, public property provision that
right.
would apply citywide. But look, we're going to have to talk about it and find a sensible way. It does not make sense, though, to enact ordinances generally where you know from the get-go you're not going to enforce. So until a city can enforce something, then perhaps it shouldn't be passing things that it knows in advance, perhaps, that it can't cover or won't cover in the entirety of the city.
And what about with city vendors during festivals or, you know, those kinds of things, or even block parties that neighborhoods may put together on city streets with properly addressed permits? Would the ordinance ban foam containers from those kinds of festivities?
Sure. So those would be activities in the public streets. And one of the discussions that Susanna knows that, you know, was expressed during the commission meetings was, you know, perhaps the municipality, if we're the ones in part espousing this ideal, we should lead by example. whether it's containers at City Hall that are used by, you know, vendors that, that sell foodstuffs at City Hall, or, like you said, at different community fairs or gatherings. Mm-hmm. We, as a condition of the licensure of that vendor, we would note that they would not be using plastic bags or styrofoam materials.
Plastic bags, there it is. I was waiting for that phrase, Mr. Mayor. We know Coral Gables has had a robust debate about it. Is it polystyrene today for Hollywood and plastic bags next quarter, maybe?
Plastic bags. Well, I'll tell you, again, I think all of the consideration of how we can, you know, push ourselves forward to be better environmental stewards has to always be coupled with the readiness of the business community and the society to change the way we do things. And so I think what I'd like to see is a lot more of a community discussion, and also the readiness of the business community to use paper bags, for example, and not mm-hmm. plastic, before we jumped on into pushing people faster than they otherwise are ready to be pushed.
And we know that the issue about whether or not cities can regulate plastic bags is an issue that remains in the courts at this point anyway. The mayor of Hollywood, right. Josh Levy. Mayor Levy, thanks so much for your time today on the Florida Rondo. Much appreciated.
Thank you.
And Susanna Bryan with us from the South Florida Sun Sentinel via Skype. Susanna, nice to have you on the program. Thanks for sharing your reporting with South Florida, too.
Thank you so much.
Still to come is the pledge edition of the Florida Roundup continues. We talk with a nursing home CEO about the push to require homes to have emergency generators. That's next as the Roundup continues. Welcome back to a special pledge edition of the Florida Roundup here on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks, as always, for listening and supporting public media in South Florida. This week, the death toll of residents at the Rehabilitation Center at Hollywood Hills rose. 14 people who were staying at the center during Hurricane Irma, when it lost electricity, have now died. The facility's license has been suspended, and its 245 employees have been laid off. The calendar, meantime, is counting down on Governor Rick Scott's mandate for nursing homes and assisted living facilities to have emergency generators installed within 60 days. That requirement is being challenged in court. In the meantime, bills have been introduced this week in the Florida House and Senate that would require these facilities to have backup power in case the electricity goes out. Molly McCrinsky is the Deputy Secretary, Division of Health Quality Assurance for the Agency for Healthcare Administration. That's the state agency regulating nursing homes.
The issues related to residents residing in locations for multiple days without power and hot temperatures was a pervasive issue in our experience after the storm.
McCrinsky this week spoke to the Florida Senate Appropriations Subcommittee on Health and Human Services to give an update on the emergency rules for nursing facilities emergency power plans in the state of Florida. The Honorable Elaine Bloom is with us, President and CEO of Plaza Health Network, former State House representative here in Florida. And welcome back to WLRN after many years.
Thank you very much.
Wonderful to have you. You run 7 rehabilitation, skilled nursing, and long-term care centers dotting Dade County. Do your facilities all have emergency power?
Of course. It's actually required by building codes throughout the state. And there are almost 700 skilled nursing facilities throughout the state, and only about 6 of them do not have backup power. The number that I used about a week ago was that 20 did not, because I had heard that they were grandfathered in by earlier building codes. But actually, all of these nursing homes do have backup power, but it doesn't require at this point to have cooling facilities.
Right. The Rehabilitation Center in Hollywood Hills had a generator, had backup power, was doing cooling areas as well. So it's not necessarily the total solution to the tragedy that played out a month ago at the Rehabilitation Center. Describe your resources at your facilities.
Well, my facilities, most of them have the ability to take care of emergency as well as the normal things such as call buttons, lights, elevators, oxygen things of that nature.
Are they considered full facility generators?
No, because they do not have to cool the rooms.
I see.
Of my facilities do have complete cooling for the rooms, and in other cases we have we are able to use common areas to cool the cool people during the time that they're in those common areas, like dining rooms,
right,
for example.
To be able to congregate some of the residents together in
yes.
one room and the AC is turned on there via the emergency generator.
I agree totally that we should have the ability for full generator power to provide cooling, but I do not agree with the 60 days from the governor's initial recommendation for that rule. Because here in Dade County, for example, you can't even get a permit to start work within that time frame. So facilities like ours have to ask for variances in order to be able to do whatever needs to be done to bring things into line.
So there's several kind of proposed regulations and emergency orders in play here. The emergency order, as you mentioned, is the governor's emergency order, this 60-day period from when he declared that the nursing homes that don't have emergency backup power must have emergency backup power. But does that affect your network of seven homes if they have emergency power currently?
Five of them would be. But the fact, again, as I say, we, for example, have 3 days' worth of fuel. And originally, the emergency rule called for 4 days,
That's
96
right.
hours.
Right.
Well, fortunately, yesterday, the governor restated, the governor's, actually the agency head, restated that, and now they say for 3 days. So we are in compliance with the three-day requirement. But it's something that needs to be worked with.
Are you in compliance with the emergency order?
With the exception of having the necessary in this case, we're going to use some portable
right.
Air conditioning units in some of the common areas. So we've already looked into being able to purchase these. But again, you don't qualify. You don't answer the requirements of the rule unless you speak to every single provision of the rule.
Right. So we're speaking with the Honorable Elaine Bloom.
But I'm not objecting to it.
Understood. You're objecting to the time frame,
That's
not
correct.
The intent,
that
not the
correct.
Goal of it. Gotcha. Elaine Bloom is the president and CEO of the Plaza Health Network, running seven rehabilitation and skilled nursing and long-term care centers in Dade County. Also a former State House representative in Tallahassee representing Dade County. What about that 60-day deadline that the governor put in place? Leading Edge Florida, which is an industry trade group in the long-term care, skilled nursing, nursing home care, has concerns and stated these concerns, challenging this order in court about the short time frame and the facilities that need to upgrade electrical systems, for instance, in order to order, procure, and install the generators. What is a more logical time frame in your estimation?
Probably more than 6 months. I know that sounds like a lot when you're considering the comparison to 60 days. We are members of the Florida Healthcare Association, the other statewide organization representing long-term care facilities, and FHCA represents about 80% of all of the facilities, and I believe that they have asked for at least a six-month period.
And the difference in 60 days versus 6 months, this four-month additional time at least that you're advocating for, is because of?
Number one, you need to be able to get engineers, electricians, get the, in many cases, new generators. I mean, I'm going to give you a case in point. We had a facility with an excellent generator. The generator worked as needed. The electricity came on in this city on the third day, so only 2 days out of electricity.
Mm-hmm.
And then there was a power surge, and the generator had to kick on again. And then there was, again, electricity. Again, there were five power surges. By the fifth power surge, the electricity, the generator gave out. Now we had to cope with having to have a repair, and the repair required a part to be sent in from out of town. You can't plan for all of these
right.
things like that. So I would say that in order to be acceptable to almost everybody involved, we would need at least 6 months.
And what about the economics of this? We've seen previous legislative efforts fail for many different reasons. One of those being, frankly, the economics of this, the state being asked to subsidize some of this for some nursing home operators.
In 2007, the request in the legislation was that the state would subsidize 50% of the cost of generators if funds were available, which isn't, of course, a very businesslike way of doing it.
As a former legislator, you understand the answer to that question is oftentimes...
Nothing. But in fact, our facilities, we are a 501c3 nonprofit organization, mm-hmm. So we plow a lot of money into staffing and into the care that we give to our patients and residents. So we don't have a pot of money lying around to purchase new generators or new fuel tanks or whatever is needed. But we will do whatever is necessary, and that's a requirement that we accept.
Let me ask you about some of the legislative proposals now, as the state legislature will meet in January. We've gone through a week of committee meetings as they're beginning to pepper each other with new legislative proposals, including several proposals regarding this emergency power at nursing homes, skilled nursing facilities, and assisted living facilities. One of them wouldn't necessarily require to have to run an entire air conditioning system in a building. Is it overkill to legislatively require a nursing home to provide emergency power to essentially mimic the environment throughout the entire home as if normal shore power were working?
I believe it would be overkill. I do think, though, that you have to have a sufficient area. And when you say sufficient area, you have to take into account sufficient square footage. Everything is very documented in the law and in the rule, so that people would not be squeezed like sardines, but would be comfortable in these common areas, and that you're able to take care of everybody that's needed. The main point that I've been trying to suggest is that in order to work the system as we do, we have our staff stay on full time 24/7 during the storm, mm-hmm. So that we do not diminish in any case the amount of staff we have. And that's the system that's used by hospitals. Hospitals are the ones that come back online almost instantly,
right.
And that's good. But I think that we should treat nursing homes, skilled nursing homes, almost as if they're hospitals, the next in line.
This gets to the level of priority that communities communicate to the power company, in this case, municipalities communicate to Florida Power and Light, about which ones are the most highly prioritized buildings that need power, second priority, third priority. And as we've learned in this disaster with Hurricane Irma, nursing home facilities are not at the same priority level as hospitals and police departments and fire departments. But you think they should be?
I think after first responders should come hospitals, and after that should come skilled nursing.
So maybe create an A, B kind of, instead of 1, 2, 3, maybe 1, 2, 3, 4, push residents down, put these others down, and bring nursing homes up.
And there's another point that I'd like to offer, and that is that skilled nursing facilities, like hospitals, are usually located right near main thoroughfares so that people can get to and from work. And the thoroughfares generally have buried power lines mm-hmm. serving them. So I would like to see the Florida Power and Light bury a power line connection to the skilled nursing facilities.
Would you be
well.
Willing to invest in a portion of that cost?
If necessary.
Lane Bloom, along with us, president and CEO of Plaza Health Network, running 7 rehabilitation, skilled nursing, and long-term care centers here in South Florida, and former State House lawmaker from Dade County. Elaine, nice to see you. Thanks for sharing your experiences with
us. Thanks,
Tom. Much appreciated. Finally, on the roundup this week, if you're a regular visitor to Lincoln Road in South Beach, you may have seen Irene Williams walking up and down the pedestrian mall over years. She did it for 40 years, making her royalty on the road. She worked as a sonographer and made her mark, though, with bright colors and bold patterns that she wore, sticking out even in South Beach. Imagine that. Eric Smith made a short film about Irene. Here's a clip from WLRN's Alicia Zuckerman's interview with Smith.
Can you just describe there's the scene. I think it's the first day that you met her. She's wearing
the avocado outfit. So she had this outfit that was made out of avocado fake fur. I think there was a bag, a coat, and a hat, and maybe some other little accessories.
Would you believe it? I wanted this material, and the only place I could find it was in the bathroom accessory department.
So the hat was made from a commode cover or toilet seat cover.
Now, an exhibit of Irene's outfits and photos is on display at the Jewish Museum of Florida until Wednesday. You can hear the interview and see photos of Williams in her many colorful outlets at WLRN.org. That'll do it for the Florida Roundup this week. Special pledge edition. Thank you for listening. Thank you for your thoughts. And thank you, of course, for supporting public radio in South Florida. It is produced by Bridget O'Brien. Our engagement editor is Katie Lepre. Alicia Zuckerman is our editorial director, our program director, Peter J. Meritz, and our technical supervisor, Jason Zabka. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening. Thanks for pledging and supporting public radio in South Florida.